You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavor swirling together with cold brew, topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. And that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Hello, one and all. This is Leonard Maltin, and you're listening to Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
And I'm the other guy.
Baron Vaughn.
That's right. See, I prefer it when you say it because then people believe I actually exist.
And you do. I can verify it.
I don't know.
All right.
I could be a giant white rabbit.
No. All I don't think so. Listen, folks, we have a special guest today. We have a gentleman who is not only a prolific filmmaker, but one of the most avid and knowledgeable film buffs I've ever met. I'm speaking of the Emmy-winning director of Mr. Warmth, the Don Rickles Project, John Landis. Hello, John.
John Landis.
You know, I'm rarely introduced as the Emmy-winning director.
Well, I thought that's why I thought
I
it'd be interesting.
The look on your
I mean,
face.
You know, anybody could say you're the director of the Blues Brothers, and you know, Thriller video with Michael Jackson, or National Lampoon's Animal House, or Trading Places, or any of those things.
Do you know
but
an Emmy?
How often are you
or coming
introduced
to America,
like this?
Yeah.
Right,
an Emmy and $8 will get you a grande latte at Starbucks.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they actually charge you $8 for the Emmy.
No, they're free.
And by the way, though, of course, people do know your many, many movies. If you haven't seen the Don Rickles documentary that John did, it is terrific. I mean, if you're a Rickles fan, and most people are, and I showed this, you came to my class at USC, and I showed it to a group of 20-somethings who are not necessarily aware of who he was, and they loved the film.
It's very funny.
Well, yes, but also, I mean, you know, he does a lot of stuff that's politically incorrect. And,
yeah, but
you
it's
know,
almost back in vogue
that
in some
to a 20-something who's not been exposed to that kind of humor, you know, might be a little challenging or risky. They just loved him.
I know Don, since I was 18. I met him on a movie. I was a schlepper on a movie called Kelly's Heroes in Yugoslavia with Clint Eastwood and Don Sutherland and Telly Savalas and the Yugoslav Army playing World War II. And I was a very low level. They're called production assistants now. We were called gophers.
Gopher, yes.
Or schleppers. In fact, Clint Eastwood, to this day, if I see him, and I see him from time to time, he says, John, get me some coffee.
As you did once
but
upon a time.
But what I respond, unfortunately, I can't say right now. Anyway, but I've known Don since I was 18, and I've worked with him. He was in Innocent Blood. And he was, what else? I did a TV show for Steve Martin, executive produced a television series, short-lived, called George Burns Comedy Week. And I directed one. Carl Gottlieb was the executive producer and Steve Martin. And I directed one. The cast was Don Rickles, George Burns, Don Knotts, Fanny Flagg, and Stephen Collins. And I can't think of her name. Beautiful girl who unfortunately later was shot by Phil Spector. But it was a very, very outrageous episode. And I don't think I've ever laughed that hard. George Burns and Don Rickles just hearing they were hysterical.
Wowie. Well, and you just named another film of yours that I'm especially fond of, Innocent Blood.
Oh, yes.
And if people haven't seen that, I mean, vampires taking over the mafia in Pittsburgh.
It's not
your everyday film.
It's interesting because I was ahead of the curve on the vampires.
I mean,
it was just before Francis's Dracula, and I mean, there were like 8 vampire movies, and I was like the year before, and I was also too early with the mob stuff. And one of the most interesting things—
Several of your people turned up in The Sopranos.
Several? It's like 90% of The Sopranos. Tony Lip, Tony Sirico, all those guys. It was like Goomba world.
So you were ahead of both of the mafia and the vampire trend in a movie that was both.
Well, sort of. It's a pretty outrageous movie, and it's got great music by Frank Sinatra in it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Rickles plays a lawyer in it, and he has a big part. And I've known him for years, and I've worked with him, and I love him. And I realized I was at his 50th birthday, his 60th birthday, his 70th birthday, and at his 80th birthday party. First of all, I noticed how many people were not there, which was kind of frightening.
Sure.
And then I realized that I felt, they got to realize this is almost eight or nine years ago now. I felt he didn't get the respect he should. I think that people didn't understand because Don is a cabaret artist. He's not a stand-up. He's a cabaret performer. And the showrooms in Vegas, in fact, in the movie, I filmed the last performance in the last showroom in Las Vegas. And then I came back 4 months later to film them blowing it up.
Can you elaborate that difference between a stand-up and a cabaret performer? What you mean by that?
Well, a cabaret performer is someone who performs in a nightclub in a cabaret. It's a theatrical performance. A stand-up essentially is what's called a monologist.
Right.
Like, even Will Rogers could twirl a rope, though, so I shouldn't say. But he's a stand-up like Jerry Seinfeld.
Of course.
You know.
Well, Don, I know what a stand-up is. I was just wondering what
Don does not tell jokes.
Okay.
It's very unique. He does not tell jokes. You have to see him, his performance, because what he does is create an ambiance and an energy in the room where just with looks, he kills. I've seen everybody. Hmm. I mean, I from Jerry Lewis to Eddie Murphy, you know, I worked with everybody. And I've never seen anyone kill like Don Rickles in Vegas, especially in his prime. But I realized people knew him from the Carson show and know him from TV, but that's not what Don does. That's not him at his best, not even close, because you have to see him in situ with the band. He sings, he dances, he roams a room. He has more, I mean, and I thought, I have to shoot it. So I thought, I want to make a film about Don. And I went to HBO and Showtime and NBC and CBS. I went to everybody. They all told me basically to, another word I can't say.
It's a podcast. You can say whatever you want.
Oh, well, they told me to go fuck myself. They, you know, they just, they really did not, nobody cared.
Mm-hmm.
Although HBO said if I filmed his act, they would just film his act.
Right.
And, you know, Don's old school. He said, I've been doing my act for 60 years. Why the fuck would I give it away? And he's right. Plus, his act.
It's not a monologue.
You have to see it. Because every performance Don does, about 50 to 60% of it is shtick that he does. And 30 to 40% is completely improvised that night.
Yeah.
And the energy and electricity. And I said, I've got to capture it. So the deal I made with Don was, he said, you can film my act. And it was a coincidence. It was at the Sands, and it was literally the last performance in a showroom in Vegas, the old showrooms, which are now gone. Mm-hmm. And which was a Union House. It cost me a fortune. But what was interesting was you can only use 15 minutes of it. That was the deal. So I agreed to that deal. And he agreed to give me Final Cut. And then his roots go so deep that I was able, everybody from Clint Eastwood and Warren Beatty to, you know, Richie Pryor, everybody helped me and showed up. And I got tons of people who now are names, but people like Chris Rock and Sarah Silverman and all these people, or Dave Attell, so many who were up and coming, struggling young comics, who I just thought were funny, because they all worshipped Don Rickles. And I remember I got this kid, Joe Ross. What's his name? Ross. Fuck, I can't think of his name. Jeffrey Ross.
Oh, Jeff Ross. I know Jeff.
Comedy Central. But he was this really struggling guy. But I thought he worshipped Rickles. So I said, okay. So I have everybody from Steve Lawrence, you know, up down to Sidney Poitier. I mean, mm-hmm. It's old Hollywood. It's Debbie Reynolds. I mean, Don worked with Clark Gable.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud of it. And then I knew that once I got it down, it's so funny. It's truly funny that I could sell it. And so I arranged to show it, like sneak it, a part of it. It was even unfinished at an HBO comedy festival in Aspen. Mm. And of course, as soon as, I mean, you know, it killed and the house went crazy. So I was able to put it on HBO.
And if you get the DVD, now I don't often do this, but I watched every moment of the bonus material on the second disc.
All the outtakes and stuff.
Because
it's
all leftovers from the interviews you did with all these great show business people. And with Don. And I just devoured that. I loved those show business stories. And
there's
just
a whole
great
section about the history, the Copacabana, that I didn't put in the movie, but it's there in raw form. My favorite Joan Rivers story, which I didn't use in the movie. Joan was a remarkable woman. She was really a generous, I mean, the opposite of what you thought. Also fearless in a way that was so unprecedented. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, fearless. I saw her 20 years ago, I mean, a long time ago in New York, and she was riffing, and all of a sudden she said, I lost my family at Auschwitz. And the place was silent. Then she said, I waited 4 hours in the gift shop. I don't know where the hell they were. The bus left. I mean, it was the most shocking. Anyway, Joan told a story that's in the outs, but that's so wonderful that when she was a young, struggling comic in the 60s, as a woman performing in the Village, it was the height of Lenny Bruce. And Lenny was a god. He really was brilliant. And it's kind of sad because there's not much that you can see. I mean, even Steve Allen told me Lenny Bruce was a genius.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sorry I never got to see Lenny Bruce. Anyway, she worshipped him, and he was at, like, the Hungry Eye or whatever. I don't know what it was. No. Whatever it is in New York.
Cafe
in the Village. The Village, I don't know.
No, probably the Village Vanguard or Top of the Gate.
Right, something, whatever. He was a headliner, and he was a big star.
Or upstairs or the downstairs or one of those
I don't
places.
Know. But she was across the street.
Yeah.
It's on the bottom of a bill, and she was, you know, and she worshipped him. And she was struggling, and the audience had trouble accepting a young woman. And, you know, there was just – because female comics were like Toadie Fields or Phyllis Diller. The joke was they were unattractive. And here was kind of an attractive young woman who was, you know,
looked outright. Like herself.
Yeah. And she was not so outrageous then. But she was performing. And she bombed one night. You should see it because she tells it. Yeah. So she starts crying. It's very powerful. But she bombed. I mean, she bombed. It was like – it was horrible. She was, you know, a terrible performance in the audience. The 12 people walked out. No, I mean, it was just death. And she goes back to her dressing room thinking – dressing room was a hallway, you know. And she's thinking, I'm going to kill myself. It's like – and the manager comes over and goes, hey, you know who was in here? Who? Lenny Bruce. He watched your set. And she thought, no, you know. And the next morning, there was a note in her dressing room. She said, she's on very nice stationery, and it's Lenny Bruce. And it said, I was in the house last night. You were right. They were wrong. Lenny.
Wow. Wow. That's really something.
And she started crying. And she said that she had that note in her bra for 20 years until it finally just, like, dissolved. You know, the sweat just finally had died. Isn't that a great story?
Oh, it's fantastic. But, John, you are a fount of great stories. You were just telling us before we went on the air.
Wait, I just thought of another great story.
All right.
That you will love.
Okay.
British director named Ronald Neame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I knew Ronnie Neame very well. He died almost 2 years ago.
Lovely man.
Lovely man. He was a cameraman. He started in The Silence. Mm-hmm. He worked on The Lodger. I mean,
he worked on Hitchcock's silent film, The Lodger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he also was the DP on
Great Expectations.
In which we serve.
Yeah, all that stuff.
I mean, David Lean, Noel Coward. Amazing. So in the 50s, he started directing movies in the UK. He did what's the movie with Alec Guinness?
Tunes of Glory.
Tunes of Glory. Another one with Guinness, the painter that Guinness wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Horse's Mouth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he made some Prime of Miss Jean Brody. He made a lot of really good movies. And then he's offered an MGM film to shoot in Hollywood. It's in the early 50s. And Ronnie thought about it, and he thought, I want to do this. And the Brits at that time, just it was like he was a traitor. It was like, you know, they wanted, like, tear his epilepsy off. It was like, you're going to move to Hollywood? You know, it's why, by the way, someone like Alfred Hitchcock was – I mean, he had to be dying for them to knight him, you know, because they came to America and lived in L.A. And Ronnie, he just did it, and he sold his house, bought a house in the Hollywood Hills, and started working on this Lana Turner movie at MGM. Mm. And those days, you'd go to location, you'd shoot your location stuff, which was Hong Kong in this case. And so you have Lana Turner walking down a street in Hong Kong and turns and goes into a door. And then you cut to a stage in Culver City at MGM, and she comes onto the – you know, you shot It's the way they made movies then. So they shot 3 weeks in Hong Kong, and he thinks it went very well. He's very excited. Comes back to L.A. on a Friday. And they're going to go start again Monday. And on Saturday night, like around 11, he gets a phone call from his agent. And the agent says, Ronnie, don't go into work Monday. Why? Well, Lana Turner hates you. What? Miss Turner hates you, and she's had you fired. You're being replaced. And Ronnie said it was the darkest moment of his life. He thought his life, his career was over, his life was over, and he and his wife just started drinking. Well, they are British, but they just started knocking him back, you know, gin and tonics. And in the morning, he throbbing headache, and about 10 a.m., he was suicidal. I mean, it was dreadful. The phone rings. He just looks at the phone. He said he looked at the phone for what seemed like 20 minutes, and it wouldn't stop ringing. And finally, he picked it up. Hello? And a voice he didn't recognize says, hi, is this Ronnie Neame? Yes. This is George Cukor. Now, at that time, Cukor was – you can place it, Leonard, because he was shooting Les Girls or Les – you know, with Leslie Caron and – what was it called? The Les Girls Les with Girls. Gene Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Cukor was directing that movie at that moment. Wow. So he was the biggest director in Hollywood. And Ronnie's – George Cukor, he said, yes, Mr. Cukor. He said, I bet you're feeling pretty low. He said – yes. He said, yeah, I heard what happened. So I thought I should call you. Why? Because I wanted you to know this means nothing and you're going to be fine. Just remember, I'm the guy they fired from Gone with the Wind. Isn't that a wonderful story?
That's great. That's great.
It just reminded me. I'm sorry.
Now,
no need to apologize. Trust me.
There's so many more stories to come. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with John Landis.
Smello, and welcome back to Melton on Movies.
Smello?
What? What's wrong with Smello?
Well, nothing, I guess.
There's always room for Smello.
Yeah, okay.
Welcome back to Melton on Movies.
It's called Faith. I'm going on faith all with right. you here, Baron.
I love how much disappointment you had right there. Just like, of all things, Vaughn, to say, well, we're here with guest John Landis.
Yes, we are.
Talking now, about stuff.
Talking about all sorts of stuff. Now, John, everybody knows, or people who are in the know certainly are aware, that you directed Michael Jackson's incredible video, Thriller. But you, just before we went on the air, were telling us a really interesting story about Michael Jackson. Would you share it with our audience?
Sure. I have lots of Michael stories because I worked with him several times, made Black or White and stuff. Mm-hmm. But my favorite story about Mike is one he told me. When we were shooting Thriller, 1983, it was remarkable and kind of odd, but who his friends were, who he had acquaintances with. So while we're shooting, you know, we only shot 3 days, so it's not like an epic. But while we're shooting, Marlon Brando, Elizabeth Taylor, Spanky McFarlane.
Yes. I know about that. I know about their relationship.
Spanky McFarlane.
You know who that is?
I don't know who that is. It's my favorite name I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, one of the stars of Our Gang, also known as the Little Rascals.
Oh,
that's Spanky. Spanky.
Yep. Yes.
The Spanky.
Oh, the definitive Spanky.
The one and only Spanky.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, this guy, you know, this older guy, kind of heavy, steady. Says, John, do you know Spanky McFarlane? I went like, say what? You know, anyway, he was lovely. But Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, I mean, just extraordinary. It was really amazing because Michael, talk about movie fans and movie students. He studied the Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly things. And he had, at that time, he had that same work ethic. He just, you know, he worked at it. And, you know, this is a guy in the wings when he was a kid. He used to just study James Brown. And Jackie Wilson, and Wilson Pickett, and Otis Redding, and, you know, Marvin Gaye, and, you know, Ike Turner. He watched and learned. Mm-hmm. And Sammy Davis is the most obvious one, you know. But anyway, so, although the best, I'm going to interrupt myself, the best Thriller story that I've told hundreds of times, but indulge me, is we're shooting in downtown L.A. in still not a nice neighborhood, but at that time it was downright dangerous neighborhood. We had a heavy police presence because of the gang stuff. And Michael had his, you know, trailer. It was Winnebago. It was like near the railroad tracks. It was like Night of the Living Dead down there. The homeless. It was really kind of scary and gangs. And, anyway, and we're shooting, and I'm shooting something. It was a meatpacking plant that we built the cemetery in, and I'm shooting something. And Michael's assistant comes up to me and says, John, Michael would like to see you. I said, all right, tell him I'll be 15 minutes and I'll come. So 15, you know, I finish and I go outside and cross the thing and walk up to his Winnebago. And you know how you step in a Winnebago, you step up.
Right.
I go, and I open the door and I step up and Mike goes, John, do you know Mrs. Onassis?
Wow.
And it's like, it's the only time in my life, I'm literally speechless. Mm-hmm. Like, it's Jackie Kennedy. What the hell is it? Was just so surreal. Mm-hmm. Who, by the way, was lovely. Mm-hmm. and looked just like
Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah,
that's right.
Wow.
Right.
I mean, it was just like, what? Anyway, so Michael, when he was a kid, when they first moved to LA, their first house, I don't know where their first house was, but then they moved to Bel Air. They leased a house in Bel Air for a while, for like 5 years. And their neighbor was Fred Astaire. And Fred Astaire had then he moved to San Ysidro. Where, mm-hmm. But at that time, we're talking a long time ago, he had a dance studio, not very large, like half the size of a garage. One side was a mirror. We had a bar and a spring wooden floor. It was a proper dance studio. Mm-hmm. And Fred would work stuff out there. And he was a perfectionist, you know. He worked mm-hmm. hard. And what I love, because I happened to, when Michael told me this story, we were with Fred Astaire, so I know it's true because Fred was smiling, you know. He called Michael a hell of a mover, which from Fred Astaire is high praise.
Yeah.
But what was interesting was there was a time in Michael's life for like 3 years, and I don't know what the years were, but like it was young. It was 9, 10, 11 mm-hmm. or somewhere in there. I don't know when it was. But every Sunday morning, Michael would go over to Fred's, and the two of them would take their shoes off, and in their socks, they dance their ass off watching Soul Train with Don Cornelius.
If only we had a photo.
Can you imagine? A photo? Video. I would like just to see it.
To be
I
there. Mean,
my God. I first thing I said was, did you ever shoot this? You know, Fred went, no. What? He thought it was such an odd thing to say.
Mm. Wow.
He was old man then.
Wow. I know that you have actually pursued the opportunity to meet people that you admire. It's not chance, not by chance that you've had lunch with different people.
I grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I was born in Chicago, but my parents moved to West LA near UCLA when I was like 2 months old. Mm-hmm. I was a surfer. Like, I'm from LA. I'm an LA mm-hmm. guy. And it's funny, though, because people always think I'm from New York, mm-hmm. which it took me years to understand what they meant was, Jew! But in fact, I'm from the same neighborhood as Dustin Hoffman and Albert Brooks, mm-hmm. you know, West L.A. And I knew when I was 8 years old what I wanted to be when I grew up. And that is my single advantage, because people talk about, you know, how did you, what did you – I saw The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, the Harryhausen, mm-hmm. Nathan Duran movie, mm-hmm. at the Crest Theater on Westwood Boulevard when I was 8 years old. I had total suspension of disbelief. It did everything a movie's supposed to do. I was transported. And I came home and I said to my mom, like Ray Harryhausen used to talk about King Kong that
right,
way.
Exactly.
And lots of kids talk about Star Wars that way. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just that the movie that did it. Mm-hmm. And I was the right age at the right moment. And I asked my mom, I said, who does that? Who makes the movie? And my mother said, the director, which was remarkable that she said that. I don't know why. I mean, it's really kind of sophisticated, which my mother isn't. But we have no relatives in the business. You know. Mm-hmm. But I did go to school with kids whose parents were like writers of TV shows and musicians. And, you know, so I knew lots of people whose fathers were in the business mm-hmm. or mothers were actors or whatever. But so when I was 8 years old, I was a maniacal film. I was like you, a maniacal film buff. You mm-hmm. know, I've seen pictures of little Leonard Maltin standing there with extraordinary people. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Didn't you meet Stan Laurel?
No, but I got a wonderful autographed photo from him.
I'm so jealous.
I met Buster Keaton.
Yeah, I'm so jealous. Mm-hmm. That's, you know. But I made an effort, a real effort, to meet people. So I knew Hal Roach. I knew Alan Dwan. I mean, I actually knew them, you know. And the story I always tell is when I was a mailboy at Fox at 67, I guess. I'm a high school dropout. Mm-hmm. I'm a bad example. But in any case, the studios were still functioning then. Mm-hmm. And the Fox – it was when they were tearing – 66, 67 is when they were tearing down the back lot to build Century City.
Oh, gosh.
Heartbreaking. Anyway.
Huh. Yeah.
So the story that crystallizes it all for me was George Stevens, one of the great American filmmakers – director of photography for Laurel and Hardy, by the way.
Right.
But his last film, unfortunately, is a bad movie, but it's called The Only Game in Town, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Taylor and Warren Beatty. And it takes place in Las Vegas and was shot in Paris because of Taylor's tax issues with Richard Burton.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was the height of Burton Taylor. You know, this makes, you know, Brangelina, this it like looks, you know, or it's small time compared to what Burton Taylor would do is insane. And the fact that Miss Taylor was coming to the lot, they were going to do pickups and reshoots like 2 weeks mm-hmm. on the Pico lot where I was a mailboy. And I'm freaking out going, George Stevens is going to be on the lot, you know, and here comes George Stevens. In fact, you know the Shirley Temple bungalow at Fox? Mm-hmm. It's still there. Russ Meyer used it beyond the Valley of the Dolls. But anyway, but it's still there. And they completely redid it for Miss Taylor. Mm-hmm. And Richard Burton would sit in there all day and drink, basically. But he was very nice. He was very nice. I was a kid. He was very nice. In any case, the story is here comes George Stevens with like an AD. I don't know, some guy they're talking. And he was, you know what? He was probably younger than I am now, but I thought he was old, you know. But he's walking along. And I was like a hippie, so I had long hair. But to be a male boy at that time, I had to cut my hair short and wear a tie. You know, it was like the only ones who could have long hair were like directors or actors or producers. No crew people. So they're walking along, and I just had my stack of mail and on my run, and I just couldn't contain myself. And I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Stevens." He looked at me, "Yes." And I was like, I just wanted to know, I'm such an admirer of your work, and I'm so thrilled to meet you. And I'll never forget it. He said, "Oh, yeah? Name five of my films." And I went, An American Tragedy, Alice Adams, Shane, Giant, The Greatest Story Ever Told, you know.
And instantly? You did that instantly?
Of course. And didn't even name the great ones.
Nice.
And he looked at me and he went, "You're not French." It's 1967. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because – and that was – you know, Peter Bogdanovich is older than I am. But that was – these people, you know, Peter actually, he met everybody and writes and wrote beautifully about them. Very much like Kevin Bronlow.
Right.
I mean, you know, these guys, they were able to do it. They're a little older than I am. But the point is that – I lived in L.A. Yeah. You know, these people were around.
Yeah. Well, lucky you. Lucky, lucky you.
Well, sometimes.
No. I mean,
you don't always want to meet your heroes.
No, that's true. That's
sometimes
true.
They're schmucks.
Although I've had amazingly good experiences. I can count on one hand, on only part of one hand, the bad experiences I've had.
Who was it? Meeting
people. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell the world.
Will you find out and tell me later?
Definitely.
With that, we'll take one more break, and we'll be right back with John Landis. We're back, as they used to say on every TV show. We're back. Well, we are back from wherever we were. Where were we?
We entered into – so a lot of people, you know, they want to know what happens when you step into a black hole. That's where we were.
Okay.
And now we're back.
We've emerged.
I thought he was going to say something so rude.
I'm so glad that
you didn't say that. Yeah.
I'm scared to know what you thought. But no.
John, you've worked – now, Baron is a stand-up comic as well as an actor.
But he's sitting.
And at present. at present.
Also Waka Waka.
Yeah. And so I'm sure he shares my interest in and admiration for Eddie Murphy.
Yes.
And this is somebody you've worked with several times with great success. And you were just saying something during the break that I had never heard before.
Oh, sure you have.
No, I've not heard this about Eddie.
No, I was just – we were talking – Leonard was talking about when he played himself. By the way, Leonard's best performance as himself is in Gremlins 2.
Gremlins 2. Yeah. I was going to bring it up.
The New Batch.
The New Batch.
Right.
Which is – that movie, Joe Dante, who I think is a great director, there are real sections of that movie that are live-action Looney Tunes in mm-hmm. a way that's remarkable.
Yeah, which mm-hmm. is what he aspired to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, but you were talking about a quality of Eddie Murphy's that I'd not heard about.
Well, you've seen it.
I've seen him do Buckwheat.
No, you've seen him do a lot more. Eddie, I think Eddie's real genius is mimicry. He can, you know, they call it impersonators, but mm-hmm. he's not an impersonator. It's mimicry. He, if you say, sing like Stevie Wonder, sing like Marvin Gaye, you know, sing like, you know, whoever, Tony Bennett, he can do it perfectly. I mean, perfectly. Mm-hmm. His own voice as a singer, it's, you know, but he can do anybody's voice.
Wow.
And that's what I found in his first movies, just being Eddie, like in 48 Hours, that was enough. And he did his laugh and, you know, just he had such energy and mm-hmm. such an infectious smile and presence. And, but then, you know, soon enough, he had to act, you know, he had to do, and I remember, you know, I don't think he gets the credit if in Coming to America, where I introduced him to Rick Baker, because I actually saw a black director, an African American director on TV, and he was talking about blackface, the thing about corking up mm-hmm. as a thing, and he said something that offended me profoundly, because one, he didn't know what he was talking about, mm-hmm. And two, he said he basically reduced. It's a very complex and difficult subject.
Yes, it is.
But he reduced it to, he said, old Jews wanting to be young black men. And obviously he was referring to like Eddie Cantor or Al Jolson. But like the whole minstrel, the whole Burt Williams, the whole fact that African Americans had to black up to be mm-hmm. on stage. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, but anyway, it just pissed me off. So the next day I went in and I said to Eddie, you're a young African American. He said, yeah. I said, you're playing an old Jew in this movie. And because I knew he could get the voice. Mm-hmm. And he said, how am I going to do that? And I said, well, I know Rick Baker. And I convinced the studio. They gave us $50,000 with which Rick made a mold of his face and sculpted the makeup. And we did a test. And the test was so remarkable. Because Eddie literally became this guy. He walked around the lot flirting with secretaries and stuff, and he was so damn funny. And then my wife, Deborah Nadulman, the costume designer, made this incredible costume with a hump. And I mean, it's an extraordinary, that makeup. The only sad thing about Coming to America's makeups, Rick's brilliant work, is this is before silicone. So it's still foam rubber. Mm. So now they have silicone-based stuff where it's perfect.
It looks really, really great.
It's perfect. Coming to America, there's stuff where, you know, it's still foam. I mean, there's some – his Randy Watson, you know, Sexual Chocolate, that
yes,
makeup.
Yes, but to Eddie Murphy's, of course, credit and your directing, like it, you don't think that. I'm not watching Coming to America thinking about the makeup. I'm totally engrossed.
No, he's so good.
Yeah.
And Arsenio got into it. You know, people don't credit how good Arsenio is in the movie.
I credit it.
And he's in like four different makeups. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in the barbershop where there's seven people and four of them are Eddie and two of them are Arsenio.
And I have to say, you know, you were talking about seeing Ray Harryhausen movie and like that scene in the barbershop where I could tell these were two different actors that were playing multiple parts. And I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. That is exactly what I want to do.
You could tell, damn it.
I could tell, but I was a very perceptive child. So.
Do you know that the way a lot of that's improvised, and I was doing all the off-camera for everybody. So what's so funny is seeing it in the movies, very cut together. But in the dailies, I'm And I'm terrible, but I'm playing all the other parts, you know. So I'm saying some fairly outrageous things, but, you know, that should not be coming out of my mouth. You listen to it and it sounds so wrong, but it's perfect for the actors, you know, and Eddie's brilliant at that, the riffs. You know.
Speaking
you know,
of
– you know who doubled Eddie? Charlie. Every time I do an over the shoulder and stuff, it's Charlie Murphy.
Huh. Oh my.
There are no opticals in that movie.
And then Cuba Gooding Jr. sitting in the chair.
Well, Cuba had it. It's his first movie, and he actually had a line that was cut out.
It's
Trading Places is Giancarlo Esposito's first movie.
Man. If people want to see you talking about a movie you love and you know inside and out, they can go to YouTube now, or they can get the Criterion disc of Island of Lost Souls, a great underappreciated film from 1932. And we don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but as I say, the conversation you have with Rick Baker and the wonderful Bob Burns, who is a – how do we describe Bob? Bob is a talented fellow.
Bob's a film editor, and he was a professional gorilla.
Right.
He says
that on the business card, professional gorilla.
Gorilla, yeah. Right. And
curator of one of the world's great archives.
Well, he's a collector.
Right.
And he has – and by the way, he didn't buy things. Those were all given. He has, without question, the most remarkable collection of props and – models and miniatures and matte paintings and any special effect related thing from Alien to, you know, American Werewolf to all the George Pal puppetoons from Disney to.
He has the time machine.
He has everything.
Yeah. He has that wolf from American Werewolf in London, another of your films that I love. He has the wolf.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
He's got the Nostromo from Alien.
Mm-hmm.
He's got, it's extraordinary.
Anyway, you and seven-time Oscar-winning makeup artist Rick Baker.
Yeah, he's pushy, and he's seven times.
The three of you discuss Island of Lost Souls, and it is wonderful to watch.
Well, Island of Lost Souls is a movie starring Charles Laughton that is, people talk about the horror films, you know, Frankenstein and the classics from the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But because this movie was so outrageous, it's a pre-code movie.
Before the production code was imposed in 1934.
Which means it deals very explicitly with sex and violence.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't seen the pre-code movies, they're quite surprising.
Yes, they are.
And Charles Laughton is genuinely brilliant in it. And it's based on the book The Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells, which was written as an anti-vivisectionist tract. And H.G. Wells loathed the movie because it's – have you ever seen it? It's Are We Not Men?
Are We Not Men?
What is the law?
Yeah,
what is the law?
Not to eat meat. Yeah. That is the law.
Yes. And Bela Lugosi is in it and totally unrecognizable, although you recognize his voice.
Yes.
But he's wonderful.
Oh, yes.
And
oh,
it's basically about a mad scientist who's surgically – creating new life forms and taking animals and making them human-like.
Yeah, humanoids.
But that's the House of Pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a steamy, dark – Lawton's Moreau is so deviant and sadistic and sinister and gleeful and malicious. It's one of the great – bad characters in movies, and at the end, when things go wrong for him, he's literally torn to pieces, and in a way that's quite
spoiler alert
horrific.
Yes.
But his screams, you just hear his screams. It's haunting, and it's one of the film.
It's incredibly creepy. Even by today's standards,
absolutely.
I would say. Incredibly creepy film, but so beautifully done.
And there's this guy, it's a long story, but this man finds himself on this island and he's told, don't go in there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like he goes in there and he hears someone in pain. And he goes in this room and there's someone under a sheet on an operating table moaning in agony. And it's an amazing sequence as he comes forward, and finally he lifts the sheet, I won't tell you. But it's a great scene.
And photographed by the great Carl Struce.
Carl Struce. And it's a big budget Paramount picture.
Yep.
And it was, when it came out, it was not unsuccessful. In fact, it made a lot of money, but it was reviled.
Yeah.
It was so considered so unseemly because it deals – I mean the sexuality in it is so up front that it's quite shocking.
I learned something last night researching that I never knew, and I wonder if you know. The screenplay is credited to two people. Philip Wiley was a very prolific author.
He wrote When Worlds Collide,
novel. Exactly so. And Waldemar Young, who wrote a lot of Todd Browning – films with Lon Chaney, which makes a lot of sense when given this film. He wrote a whole bunch of them. He wrote London After Midnight, or co-wrote London After Midnight. Waldemar Young is the grandson of Brigham Young. I mean, that's trivia, but it's fascinating trivia.
Whoa.
The grandson of Brigham Young.
I'm being so self-censoring now.
Good, good. That's wise. That's probably wise. And, of course, this film has been remade several times.
Badly. Every remake has been bad.
The one with Burt Lancaster and Michael York.
Was terrible.
And then the notorious one with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer.
Wow.
And there's a recent documentary. Have you seen the documentary?
I've seen the documentary. It's quite odd.
It's called Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. Does it validate the film at all?
No. It's a grotesque story. And Richard Stanley, he's a young English director, had made a film called Dust Devil and suddenly was given this opportunity to make this big budget film. Mm-hmm. And it's a sad story. And the documentary does a pretty good job of telling what went on. What's scary is that Marlon Brando hijacked the movie. Marlon, I didn't know him. I met him and I had dinner with him and stuff, but he could be quite destructive if he wanted to. Mm. He made a movie with a friend of mine and he was very large and he just didn't want to be shot in anything but a medium shot. He just said, I won't be shot in anything but a medium shot. And that's kind of impossible when they're walking and talking and, you know, and they're supposed to go into the – and so the director said, I can't promise that, Marlon. I'll do my best. So Marlon came to work every day with a shirt that came just to here and no pants.
Oh, my goodness.
Remember that. Put that in your bag of tricks, Barry.
Oh, it's already in the bag.
You know, Marlon could be difficult. And in this movie – He tries to invent more and more grotesque and insane ways to sabotage the picture. And when this director was fired, they brought in John Frankenheimer, and John Frankenheimer was a hard ass.
Yeah.
And it's just a fascinating documentary, and it resulted in this grotesque movie. That's one of those
strange.
You have to see it to believe it.
Yeah. Whereas the original Island of Lost Souls is a great movie, period.
Well, what's interesting is the panther girl,
yes.
You know, that he creates out of a panther a woman that he then wants to seduce the man to – well, it's quite creepy. That's an invention of the screenwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And that character is carried into all other
the
remakes.
Ones, yeah.
It's one of the things that H.G. Wells was so horrified by. The book Island of Lost Souls, I strongly recommend if you're a Stephen King fan or if you like creepy stuff, because it's short. It's a novella. Very much like Stoker's Dracula, it's a book that will scare you.
Mm.
I mean, Dracula, which is totally postmodern because it's told in letters and journals and diaries and scare the shit out of you. It's a really scary book. And Island of Lost Souls is deeply disturbing. Island of Dr. Moreau, is a deeply disturbing book. It's genuinely great. And the first movie version of it is unique and wonderfully – and Charles Laughton. And the conceit, they're in this humid, sweltering jungle that he wears a brilliant white linen suit.
Three-piece suit.
Yes.
Yes.
With that little mustache.
Strange little mustache.
Carries that whip.
Yeah.
What is the law?
Yeah. And he was pretty new to Hollywood then.
It was his third film.
Yeah. I mean, you know, moviegoers.
Do you know his first Hollywood film?
Is it Payment Deferred?
No.
That was. It's.
The Old Dark House.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Which is another great film that Melvin Douglas. what's her name?
Gloria Stewart.
Gloria Stewart. Boris Karloff, who's genuinely scary.
Ernest Thesiger.
Ernest Thesiger.
Have a potato. Right.
It's a genuinely, James Whale directed it. The Old Dark House is a genuinely funny, really witty movie that has two great scares. Mm-hmm. Real scares.
It's James Whale too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well, James, so it's high camp, but it's really good.
And the year after this, Lawton won his Oscar for Private Life of Henry VIII, which he made back in England.
Back in England.
Wow. John, we could go on and on and on and on.
I do want to mention, because I had such a good time, I just recently was in Pordenone, Italy, to go to Cinema Muto, which is the
annual Festival of Silent Film.
Right, and we saw
which I haven't been able to go to in years.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that.
It's fabulous. I had an amazing time, and they showed the restored Phantom of the Opera with a full orchestra, and they showed a French film made in 1925, 6.5 hours long, of Les Misérables. That's the best movie I've seen in the last 5 years.
Wow, wish I'd been there.
They do it every year.
Oh yeah,
and it's extraordinary. It's mostly academics, but there are about 200 or 300 hardcore fans. Mm-hmm. But you see things. They showed Burt Williams' film.
Oh, yeah, the one that's been discovered. Yeah.
There's a woman in it. I don't know her name, but she's a revelation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm eager to see that. And I hope someday to get back to Pordenone. We had a wonderful trip there about 20 years ago and was unforgettable. Unforgettable. John, thank you so much for dropping by today. We are so much in your debt, and thank you for sharing all these great stories.
Quickly, how many times do people ask you for my autograph?
Oh, I wasn't going to go into this, but there it is, folks. there are lots and lots and lots of people out there, out and about, and especially here in Los Angeles, who think that John and I are twins.
I'm constantly approached by people.
Weird.
Mostly white people. Yeah, but I'm approached by people who say, you're on television.
Oh.
And I'll say no. They go, yes, you're Leonard Maltin.
Oh.
And I people stop me and said, Mr. Landis. Right, I've had that. Now the truth is we both have beards.
And glasses.
And we both wear glasses. That's where the resemblance ends.
That's kind of it. Yeah.
That's it. Now here's the capper
to the
story.
But Eddie Murphy said to me, one of the very few times I ever met him, you really do look like John.
Oh, fuck him. What do you mean? That's what's so – we all look alike.
Anyway, that's been it for this episode of Double Maltins.
No, but I can't wait to top that story. So I made a movie years ago, and Kirk Douglas was in it. So he was good, too. And about 4 years later, in the mail, I get a lovely letter from Kirk. He said, I found this. I thought you should have it. And it's a wonderful picture of Kirk Douglas, and it says, to John Landis, my director, something like that. But it's a photo of Kirk Douglas and Leonard Maltin. So I sent it to Leonard.
There you go.
And so it goes. John, thanks again for being here. And Baron, where can people find you before they tune in again next week?
Me, various places. What about you, Leonard?
You're in the Horsehead Show.
Yeah, I'm in the Horsehead Show. Grace and Frankie, next season of BoJack Horseman a little bit.
All right.
But stuff like that. What about you, Leonard?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Leonard Maltin. I'm online at leonardmaltin.com.
Isn't it true that some of your books are now on, what's it called?
Kindle. Amazon Kindle. 4 of my vintage film books, 1 I edited, 3 that I wrote, are now available for the first time, and for first time in many years, in revised editions. As ebooks on Amazon Kindle, and even as print-on-demand books.
I recommend the one on Comedy Shorts. I really do. It's excellent.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. So you can look at my author's page on Amazon and find all of that. Friends, thank you so much for listening. Thank you for continuing to listen. We will be back next week. Baron, good to see you.
Better to see you.
All right. Take care, folks.
Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. It's not a question, it's a statement. It's also the name of a podcast on Wolf Pop. So if you're foolish enough to disagree, listen so we can tell you how wrong you are. I'm Kevin Avery, and each week, W. Kamau Bell and I put out a new episode where we review every Denzel movie in alphabetical order, sorta, kinda. Look, we jump around a lot, all right? We're gonna do that. We're gonna catch you up on the latest Denzel news and even speculate on who would be the next Denzel. All with great guests like Omar Dorsey from the movie Selma and director Ava DuVernay. Listen to this recent clip.
I like Training Day a lot. It's one of my favorite. If it's on TV, I'm gonna sit down and watch it. But I think for a lot of people, they want to make it's like a guilty pleasure Denzel Washington
movie
because he's playing such an unredeemable character.
It's red velvet cake. You can't eat that every day.
It's red velvet cake, yes. Exactly.
Man. Eat it during Christmas. You can't have that all the time.
Yeah.
So tune into Kamau and I every week on iTunes, Wolf Pop, Howl, or your favorite podcast app, and you too will understand why Denzel Washington is the greatest actor of all time, period. Any questions?
Pop.
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 Pop. Pop.
Pop.
Pop.
Pop.
This has been a Wolf Pop production. Executive produced by Paul Scheer, Adam Sachs, Chris Bannon, and Matt Gourley. For more information and content, visit wolfpop.com.
You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew topped with a velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. And that imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. Participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.